to be here. What I want to talk about today is work that I've been doing with my group over the past few years on exploiting the phenomenon of gravitational lensing, and in particular gravitational lensing by clusters of galaxies, to study properties that characterize our universe. In particular, the properties that we have focused on so far has been the distribution of dark matter in the universe. And I also want to wrap up with showing you some new results of extending this work to not just studying dark matter, but also dark energy in the universe. So before I start, I just want to acknowledge my various collaborators, current students, former students, former postdocs, as well as some colleagues in the field, who over the years have very generously provided me with observational data as it were I needed it for my work and for the work of my students. So this is a rough outline of my talk. So what I want to start off with is discuss briefly some lensing basics so that you get an idea of the power of this technique and the elegance of this technique. And then we will focus on a particular application to clusters of galaxies, the objects that I'm going to be using as cosmological probes in the work that I'm going to discuss. And then I will focus, as I mentioned earlier, on dark matter properties, the properties of dark matter, the dark matter distribution that can one can infer from gravitational lensing studies of clusters. So these are specific properties of clusters that can infer. You can infer the mass profiles. And I will discuss briefly the sort of the limitations of the modeling. I'll give you a status report, if you will, the key results, and also discuss what the current limitations are in this work. And I will focus a little bit on substructure, the mass function of dark matter halos, the spatial distribution of dark matter halos, the density profiles, and the dynamical processes that affect dark matter halos and clusters of galaxies. And then I will move on, as I said, to presenting a new technique whose feasibility I'm currently, me and my students are currently working feverishly on, which is using gravitational lensing to also constrain the geometry of the universe and therefore give us constraints on dark energy. And then I'll conclude with some sort of future prospects. So what I want to point out here is that, you know, one of the reasons for my going through sort of systematic inventory of all the properties that we can extract, as you may all know, we know that the bulk of the matter in the universe appears to be dark matter. And we think that this dark matter is non-baryonic, and it's actually collisionless. What that means is it probably doesn't have charge, so there are no charge interactions, and we think that gravity is the dominant force that these particles feel against each other. We don't know their masses. We don't know any of their properties other than the fact that they aggregate via gravity. And what is spectacular about the work that I'm going to show you is that without really knowing the nature of dark matter, we can still learn quite a lot, which gives us very deep and important insights to the potential nature, to a potential equation of scale, if you will, for the dark matter. So this is my work before, with that scary bit about being photographed and so on. Please feel free to interrupt me at any point with questions. So I want to start off with showing you what the motivation, the observational motivation for much of this work is. The observational motivation comes from a census, cosmic census or inventory of the universe, that essentially gives us this very uncomfortable picture, right? So 73% of the composition of the universe appears to be dark energy. And dark energy happens to be this repulsive force that counteracts gravity, if you will, and that causes the accelerating expansion of the universe, okay? And the bulk of the matter distribution that is inferred in the inventory is core dark matter, whose nature we do not know. And a very, very small proportion is ordinary atoms, or baryons, that you and I and stardust can make. And there are, of course, candidates for what core dark matter could be, and some of the favorite candidates are these weakly interacting massive particles called WIMPs. So the observational evidence from many lines of evidence, I've just shown you a few. This is sort of looking at the brightnesses of supernovae as a function of distance in the universe. So there have been many, many independent probes that have led to this inventory. So this is fairly well established. Okay? So now, obviously, what we would like to understand is the details of the distribution of dark matter and whether there are any particular probes of this detailed distribution that one can infer independent of the complicated astrophysical processes that involve barriers. And gravitational lensing offers one such very, in fact, the such, the only such very, very powerful technique, because the effect that you see is independent of the dynamical state of the objects that we're going to talk about. So let me quickly give you a run through what a typical lensing scenario in the universe is. So you have a distant source, and it could be an individual quasar or galaxies, and you have an intervening mass distribution that could be of any scale. It could be a single black hole, it could be an individual galaxy, it could be a cluster of galaxies, and that's the particular case we're interested in today. You have an intervening mass distribution that is a cluster of galaxies that has a mass that is 10 to the 15 times the mass of the Sun, and that is potentially very complex. So what we're really after is to try and look at the lensing effects and figure out properties. The inversion problem we are after is looking at the lensing effect, and I'll just come back to tell you what the effect is, to use the observed effect to infer the properties of the mass distribution with an assumed prior for the distribution of sources. So what gravitational lensing does is allows you to actually infer the deflectors, properties of the deflectors along the line of sight. So essentially you have sources at high redshift, as I said, individual galaxies or clusters, and light rays from these sources are deflected due to the presence of mass concentrations. And as predicted by GR, one can calculate what these deflection angles are, and these deflection angles are measurable if these masses are large and for cosmological distances. Okay, there's of course a question of alignment. You need to have objects that are lined up behind massive concentrations in order to observe this effect effectively. Okay, so the deflection that you see is proportional to two things. It's sensitive to the mass distribution all along the line of sight. So all the matter along the line of sight in a cylinder contributes to this deflection angle. And in the particular cases we're going to be looking at, if there is going to be one dominant cluster of galaxies, a very, very massive object along the line of sight, that is the source of this deflection. The other proportionality comes from the angular diameter distances, and these quantities between the observer and the source and the lens and the source, the ratio of these angular diameter distances. So it turns out that the information about cosmology, the cosmological parameters that characterize the context of the universe, the geometry of the universe, lie here. So typically in lensing, when you measure deflections, you measure, this is an observable, you measure the deflections, and if you know the underlying cosmology, then you can map the mass incredibly well. Okay, so that's an exercise. So the first part of my talk will focus on that exercise, the exercise of measuring these deflections. These are the deflections of light rays, and what that amounts to is distortions in the shapes of these background galaxies. Okay? And the last part of my talk, I will be moving along to using the deflections to actually constrain cosmological parameters. Okay, so what does lensing actually do? So you have a distant source, so you can assume that you have, say, a spherical shape or a galaxy, light rays from this galaxy, a distant galaxy, and you have an intervening mass. Say it has a symmetry, a spherically symmetric mass distribution, and the light rays are reflected due to the presence of this mass. And what you end up seeing, instead of the original shape of the galaxy, you could end up seeing the shape mangled, distorted, into this kind of arc and a counter arc. Okay. And what you see here, the bright spot that you see in the center is actually the galaxy that is hosted in this dark cloud form, as it turns out. Right? So there's an intervening galaxy that is the lens, and it's a spherically symmetric mass distribution, you can see something like that. Just want to note, these are actually real observed Hubble Space Telescope images. Okay, so these are very, very measurable. And then you may want to understand how the symmetry properties of this mass distribution manifest themselves in these images that you see, the geometry of these images. So if you have similarly a source, but you have a ellipsoidal mass distribution, a slightly different symmetry, then you can get more complicated image geometries. A single object could get imaged multiply, say, into four, and this configuration is called an Einstein cross. And this is also seen. There's several of them seen around. However, in the real universe, clusters of galaxies have a mass distribution that we think looks rather like this. So this is the a priori hypothesis. The clusters are rather clumpy. They have a smooth dark matter distribution with a smooth density profile that is peaked in the center and falls off on the outskirts. And on top of this density profile, you have a lot of fluctuations, small scale flux. So a typical cluster, if you had to draw the density profile of this cluster, you have a smooth large scale component, and then you would have a lot of these flux. So that's the conception of the cluster. And such a mass distribution would actually give you the kind of observed effects that we see in clusters of galaxies. So I want to show you this image. So it's particularly apt to be given to Stock in Canada because the first gravitationally lensed cluster was detected in CFHT. It's not this image, but it was in 1987 or 88. But this was a cluster, and this is called AVEL-370. And what you see here is a very elongated arc, which is actually an individual background galaxy that has been stretched, magnified, and distorted due to the presence of a very clumpy dark matter distribution, which is this cluster of galaxies. What you see as yellow spots here are bright early type galaxies, the light from bright early type galaxies that are members of this cluster, that are bound to this cluster. Okay? And what is shown here is to illustrate a very important point, which you might have picked up already from my little sketches, that what matters in lensing, aside from the detailed geometry of the mass distribution, is the alignment. So if you line up right behind the densest part of the intervening lens, you get multiply imaged. A single background galaxy gets multiply imaged. Okay? And that's what is shown in this animation. So you have, but if you, once you move away from the center and you're not as perfectly aligned, you may not get such a dramatic arc, you may get a smaller distortion, or as you move way further out from the cluster center, you may actually only see a weak distortion in the shape of a galaxy, a background galaxy. So here you have the sources, the high redshift galaxies typically. And so there are these various regimes, so the regimes in gravitational lensing where you see very different observational effects. So in this regime, where the deflections, there are maximal deflections, because light rays are penetrating the densest part of the intervening mass distribution, so this is the cluster mass distribution, so this is the region, the densest region of the cluster, you get an individual source multiplying image. Okay? Because surface brightness is conserved by gravitational lensing, so you can think of lensing this really as a mapping between shapes of sources and shapes of the images they produce, and that mapping conserves surface brightness, you would see a circular source that gets multiply deformed, actually magnified. So these bits are magnified compared to the true magnitude of the object, of the background object. As I mentioned, as you go further out from the center, when you're no longer in perfect alignment, you know, you have sources everywhere, the sources that are not perfectly aligned actually just get slightly elongated. So a circular source will just become an ellipse. In addition to just becoming an ellipse, as you will see, the preferential orientation. So these, what you see as blue blobs here are background galaxies, which are lying behind the cluster that are getting dense. Notice they all started out as, this is a little simulation where they were all originally shaped as circles. Notice that they're all elongated. And there's a preferential tangential alignment around the densest part of the cluster. Okay? And as we move out, you no longer have multiple images. You no longer have dramatic shearings of shape, which are very weak shearings of shape. And as you go further out, this effect gets weaker and weaker. So the shapes here are deformed dramatically, say about 50% or so. And as you go further down, the shapes are deformed at a 10% level, and here is 5% level. And when you go, what else is observed is you go further in the cosmos, even in regions where you do not have clusters, but have a rather filamentary dark matter distribution, you find that the shapes of background galaxies are sheer at the 1% level, and you might have heard that effect that has probably been talked about here by people called cosmic shape. That's 1% effect, okay? So cluster lensing is much more dramatic, so it's not as challenging to detect as cosmic shears, for instance. Okay, and so much of the analysis is to use these multiple range of effects on different scales And what I mean by skins is different regimes of cleansing to reconstruct the properties of this class distribution. And to do so, one really thinks of lensing as a mapping between a source plane and an image plane. And one thinks of mapping the shapes of objects from the source plane to the image plane via this reflection angle, which is proportional therefore to the mass, as well as the ratio and the diameter distances. And the reason Einstein's picture is right here is obviously all of this is very easily calculable and is a very beautiful, elegant, and simple formalism just using GR. The deflection angle is very easily calculable for a range of mass distributions. So you may wonder, this field is a very, very new field. And the reason this field is very, very new is because you needed exquisite resolution in order to detect these, even these highly distorted magnified arcs. And therefore, the presence of the optically connected Hubble Space Telescope has transformed this field. And the field is about 10 to 12 years old in terms of the highest quality resolution imaging that was available that allows us to do all this modeling, this very sophisticated modeling that we can now do. So to just show you the difference, this is a ground-based image from 1986 of this cluster scale to 2244. This is an arc, highly distorted, and this is the same cluster imaged with HST. Okay, it's dramatic, the difference is dramatic. And the reason why does it matter? It's the locations of these multiple images. So there's a single background source that's multiply imaged into this one and a counter image here that are used to constrain the mass distribution. Okay, so Hubble Space Telescope, and really has transformed this field. Okay, and before that, a lot of the work, and almost all the results I will be talking to you about today, we cannot do this whole thing now. But luckily, there is enough data from Hubble Space Telescope, not all of which has been exploited yet. Okay, so we have a huge amount of data that's already available, and we can do some fantastic science with it. And I'm hoping to show you what all this imaging from space has allowed us to do in terms of constraining models. Models both for the detailed distribution of dark matter in the cluster, as well as potential probes of cosmology. So 20 years ago, the first arc redshift was discovered. And how do we know it's gravitational lensing? Because if you go and you take the spectra of these multiple images, they have identical spectra. The probability that more than three objects lying so spatially close would have identical spectra in the universe is practically zero. So we know that they are multiple images of the same background galaxy. Okay? So that was confirmed, and that needed to be confirmed, and it still needs to be confirmed when we put on fine lenses. So this is another cluster, ABEL-370, and there's a very, very dramatic arc here in this encounter arc. So what does this allow us to do? These images, what do these images allow us to do? They actually allow us to probe the mass distribution of the cluster as a big pushing hard so far. But six clusters of galaxies are unique in the sense they are about 1% of the mass of a cluster is in galaxies, and there's these very bright galaxies that are held together by the gravity of the dark matter, and about 10% is in the X-ray gas that is held in the dark matter potential, but the rest is all dark matter. So they're very heavily dark matter dominated objects. However, emission from the X-ray gas is also independently detected. So we can combine what we see from the gravitational lensing effects for the mass model of the cluster and see if it is consistent with what we derive from the X-ray emission detected in the same gravitational potential. Okay? And we also, the other thing that gravitational lenses by us, cluster lenses by us, is that you can start seeing objects that are at such distances from us, sources at such high redshift that you would not ultimately detect any other way. So serendipitously, they happen to lie behind the cluster lens, and they are highly magnified. These very faint sources are highly magnified, and you actually detect them. Okay, and no future telescope in space or elsewhere you would ever detect some of the sources that I'll be showing you. So it's very, very powerful. So let me quickly give you just a sense, a feel for the equations. They're very, very simple. Calculating light reflection. So what really matters in determining the measured deflection alpha is the projected gravitational potential, so it's the 2D gravitational potential of the mass that lies along a cylinder along the line of sight. So the deflection angle is just the gradient of that potential. And furthermore, we can make, because of the cosmic distances involved, we can make a couple of very useful simplifications and approximations. And there's a very useful one that is called the thin length approximation, which allows you to basically ignore the detailed extent of the mass distribution along the line of sight compared to the distances that we're talking about. So the angular diameter distances are so large, the sources are so far behind, that we don't have to worry about the extension of the lens itself. We ignore that, and that is called the thin lens approximation. So what is really interesting is that the deflection angle, as I said, can be written as the gradient of this projected two-dimensional gravitational potential, is actually proportional to a quantity that is called kappa, which is the scale, the surface mass density in the plane, in the lens plane. So what we do is we define something called the lens plane, along which we collapse all the mass in the cylinder. And kappa is the convergence, or it's a scaled surface mass density. Okay, so this is the quantity that we can derive from observations. So the image reflection, if you will, alpha, is directly proportional to the surface mass density. Okay, it's the surface mass density in the lens plane. As I mentioned earlier, it is very useful and it's effective to think of lensing as a mapping. So you have on the source plane, you can imagine, you know, the circular source.
So can I ask a stupid question? So if I knew nothing about gravity and GR and I had some lensing, how would I know that what's coming to me is not an homogeneous index refraction, just spanning some kind of boundary in space?
That's what it is. Equivalently, that's what it is.
So the GR comes in fact, the background of these equations as giving me the input of how the fraction
changes. Absolutely. So actually, you can derive the equation that I derived actually using Fermat's principle. So it is really, that's a very good question. So what it is the reason this whole thing is called lensing is because you can do the analogy to geometrical optics. So where you have a candle, and many of you, well, in a high-density experiment in high school anyway, where you have a candle and you have a concave or a convex lens, and you have a screen, and depending on the relative orientation with respect to the focus of this lens or the source, you can see converted image, magnified image, demagnified image, and so on. And what is really happening, analogous to here, the reason you see the effect in geometrical optics, is the effect of changing refractive index, the change in refractive index between air and glass. And that's very, very similar to what we see here. Except the GR formulation is actually a factor of 2 over a classical calculation.
Can I have another question?
Sure.
So, in all of your demonstrations, you start with a nice circular source, and then you get a
image.
How do you know that in service you're.
Well, sure, this is just illustration. I'll show you. So, what we do know, we have the prior probability distribution of the intrinsic shapes of galaxies. Because most of the universe, the covering area on the sky of dense clusters is very, very small. So most cylinders in the sky through which we look will not contain a dense deflector, a massive deflector. So looking through many, many patches of sky, we do actually have a very, very good handle on the prior probability distribution of the shapes. This is a shape parameter. We know what the intrinsic shape parameter distribution is for galaxies. And in fact, you know, it's a great question because this is one of the fundamental limitations. The dispersion of this relation is one of the fundamental limitations of all lensing work. The fact that it's not that large, but it is finite, and that, you know, so it gives you a limit because that's the dispersion. It gives you an error, effective error, with which you can actually reconstruct shapes. So this is just for the simplicity to show you the two systematics in lensing. So you first have a shearing in the shape, then you have an orientation. So to show that, it's easier to start with a circle and show you the limits. So what you see here are two things. You see the circle deformed as an ellipse, and you see a tilting. I've drawn the background here just to show you that there's a change in orientation as well. So you can see the whole thing is shifted a little bit manual. So there's a rotation. So you can write this mapping, it's written often in terms of what we call an amplification matrix, where we have this component kappa that I just showed you, which is the convergence, which is related to the surface mass density in the Lenz plane. And you have this other component, which is called gamma, which is the shear. That is a complex number and has two components. And it's the piece that gives you the shearing, the shape, the change in shape. And that is related to the second derivative of the projective potential. So there's one other interesting thing I want to point out here, the definition of kappa, where it is proportional to the surface mass density. In fact, it's proportional to the scaled surface mass density, where you're scaling by some critical value. And this critical value is a critical value for a given configuration. So for a given source at a particular distance or direction from us, and a given lens whose redshift or whose location we actually know, this number is scaling. Okay? So this is a scaling quantity, and we can calculate from the data, we can calculate both kappa and gamma. And in fact, it turns out we don't independently get kappa and gamma from the data, but what we really measure is this quantity called G, which is called reduced shear, which is a combination of kappa and gamma. It's basically gamma on the one minus kappa. And to give you a feel, in the center of clusters, kappa, the magnification can be a factor of 100 to 20. Okay? Whereas the shear, as I told you, is often quite small as you go further up. The shear is very large in the center as well. Right? Once again, to give you a feel for what the observed geometry of images is actually telling you about the underlying symmetries of the gravitational potential. So let me illustration here. So this is the source plane. And I rotated it by 45 degrees just to exaggerate the fact that there's an orientation change as well in lensing. Okay, so this is the image plane or the lens plane, and this is the source plane. So when you have perfect alignment of a circular source behind an elliptical lens, so a mass distribution that has ellipsoidal symmetry, so when you project it, it has an elliptical symmetry, you have a source here perfectly aligned with the densest part of the mass distribution, then you get these four images of the same object. So follow the red, right? You get these four images. And in fact, you actually get a fifth image. You will actually get a demagnified central image here, which is often quite hard to detect because it's demagnified. And often, you know, you have a galaxy that's, you know, a set of galaxies being hosted by this dark matter halo, the mass concentration, so you may not actually see the central demagnified image. As the source, if the source lines up, not right in the center, but further out, right, then you see these very different configurations. So now you can see the given the symmetry of a gravitational potential configuration and alignment for a source, for a circular source, you can actually spot. And the reason for showing you this is, in the next image, I'm going to show you one of the most dramatic gravitational lenses, and you will all now be able to pick by eye these families. So these are called families. I will refer to them as families. So a blue source that is imaged into three. Notice the relative orientation of the three blue arcs compared to the red ellipses. Right? So there's a difference in both. And notice that once you hit a certain line of sight away from the central dense part of the mass distribution, the light green bit, the light green bit, there is no multiple imaging. There's only a single image, and it's just highly elongated. So I'm just illustrating you the strong lensing regime where a single source is multiple image. Moving on to the weak lensing regime where a single source is only imaged once, but it's elongated and distorted. And all of the work that I'll be showing you will be incorporating both these effects because you have sources of all, you know, a whole distribution of sources behind the cluster. So you have sources spanning this entire spatial range behind the cluster. So you will see all these effects at the same time. Okay? So this cluster is a galaxy cluster, EVAL-2218, and you must have all seen many, many images of this. And I like to refer to this cluster as sort of the Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie of gravitational lenses, like over photographed, you know, over celebrated, perhaps not as much consequence, because I'll show you some other lenses which actually provide us more concrete constraints than this one. But this is one of the earliest clusters that the Hubble Space Telescope saw. So I think maybe you can see it without the light being far with him, but you can all pick out by eye now these multiple arcs. All of them that have been imaged. So this cluster has 18 of them. 18 sets of sources that have been multiply imaged. Okay, some much more dramatically than others that you can pick up. So the other thing that you can pick up right away is that you can pick up this one here, you can pick up this system, that system, that system. And what's really interesting is that in order to do very effective modeling work, you not only need to identify these systems and understand the symmetry that it implies, but also you need the redshifts of these arcs to know where these sources are actually are, because that allows you to calculate the mass distribution, right? So one of the things you can pick up right away by looking at this cluster, so all these fuzzy blobs that you see are galaxies that belong to the clusters. So they're all part of the reflector. They're all part of the lens. So the lens consists of a cluster, which is about 1,000 galaxies and a gravitational lens together. And all these fuzzy sort of yellowish bits are actually cluster galaxies. They're all in the lens plane, okay? Notice immediately that the fact that you see a dramatic lensing effect around this area of the cluster, which is the deep arcs, sitting right on the tells us that there's a nice mass peak sitting here too. So there are actually two peaks in this mass distribution. So just by eye, you can figure out that this is going to be a slightly complicated mass distribution. So how do you actually measure? What are the measurements that you make? The measurement, as I said, is you look at the electricity of the image, and with a prior for the intrinsic electricity of the source, the undistorted electricity, you can write the image electricity as just the sum of the intrinsic one plus the shearing produced by gravitational lensing. Okay? And what is interesting about looking at these shapes, in the weak lensing regime, you will no longer have multiple images, and instead what you have are these sort of weak systematic distortions. So all the analysis in the weak lensing regime is statistical. Okay, in the strong lensing regime, you have individual objects that are multiply imaged. You can pick them out, you can measure where their redshifts are. There are, by contrast, there are many, many more objects that are weakly shaped. And you cannot, it's prohibitive to go get their redshifts. So you don't actually know where those objects are. Okay, and we have to assume a distribution, a redshift distribution for those objects, for galaxies. So it turns out, we got to this a little ahead, that one of the key limitations in this lensing inversion has to do with the dispersion in the intrinsic ellipticities, the intrinsic shapes, undistorted by lensing shapes of galaxies. Galaxies are born with a range of shapes that has to do with the tidal torques in the dark matter in the regions where galaxies are seeded. Okay? But the width of that electricity distribution is one of the key limitations, as is, of course, the number of galaxies. In the weak regime, right? Because it's statistical, you're limited by Sharpe numbers, by the total number of galaxies that you can get. So give you a little bit more of a feel for how you can actually extract information statistically. Let's take a look at this panel, where what you see in black is the undistorted shape, undistorted by lensing, distribution, intrinsic shapes of background galaxies without any lensing. So this is from a simulation. So with that as a prior, then I plop a very massive cluster in front of it, and this is what it does to the electricity distribution. Notice it does two things, right? It shifts the mean, and it increases the distribution. Okay, and obviously, if this was a delta function, that would be nicer, because then it would be a much tighter shift, it wouldn't be such a widespread. Unfortunately, we're stuck with this. And as I said, we work in the weak lensing regime, so the outskirts of the cluster, which is the bulk of the area of the cluster where you have data, the distortions are weak, so it's all statistical analysis. As I mentioned, we don't know where each of those individual background galaxies is, in contrast to the multiple images, which are bright enough that we can go get spectroscopy and we know where they are. So what we actually do is astronomers have devised techniques, clever techniques, to assign redshifts by looking at the spectral energy distribution of galaxies, classes of galaxies, as a function of their magnitude and their distance and their morphology. So we have methods, these photometric methods, that allow you to look at the magnitude of a galaxy in a given band, and with some probability assign a redshift to that. So as you can imagine, this is a very, very important piece of this game. And this is a piece of the game that is rapidly moving and evolving. It's a source of error. It's a key source of error. in our reconstructions in general. For constructions that depend only on weak gravitational lensing, these are very, very significant errors arise from the unknown true redshift distribution. However, in the cases that I'm talking about, when you have a cluster where you see strong gravitational lensing effects as well, they are not as much of a problem because the strong gravitational lensing features with their metal redshifts allow you to actually calibrate the mass. So what I want to show you here briefly is that this is the center of the cluster, and that's a blow-up of this cluster. This is another one which is very dramatic. It produces five images of the same background galaxy that looks like a bicycle wheel with no spokes and a few bright star formation blocks. It's very, very simple. What is very interesting and shown in red sticks here, these are just average shapes of galaxies, background galaxies, in patches as we go away from the center. So this is the center that I've drawn up here. So when you go well outside the cluster center, you are still seeing the Fourier lens distortion. Okay? So the mass distribution of clusters is quite extended, and what you're really seeing as you go farther out is some smooth distribution that is really tailing off, okay, a density profile that is really tailing off to quite large media. But what is very interesting is from the simulations I showed you, I said that there would be a systematic tangential along that. Notice that you see deviations from that pattern. You look at the sticks, they are not all regularly tangential. And what that points to are the presence of clumps, local gravitational potential wells that distort the shear field locally on very small scale. In fact, that's what we are after. What we are after is systematically extracting the deviations from the tangential, smooth tangential shear field, looking at the small scale deviations and ascribing those deviations to the locations of individual dark matter points. Okay, so that's what the optimization involves. The optimization, therefore, involves using the highest resolution image that you can possibly get, doing the best possible measurement of shapes, and then looking at the deviations in the systematic shear field as a function of radius. And use that to quantify the clump. So just to reiterate, the work involves combining strong lensing and weak gravitational lensing. For cluster data from the Hubble Space Telescope. And how does this work? So as I said, the inner region, to actually see multiple imaging, the surface mass density in the inner regions has to exceed a certain critical value. Okay? And this critical value, as I mentioned before, depends on the angular diameter distance known, or you can calculate what sigma critical is if you know where the lens is, where the cluster of galaxies is, and where the source that is getting multiple images. Right? And what is very interesting is that this quantity, the mass enclosed within the arc, the dramatic arc that you see, is very, very tightly constrained if you know where the source is and you know where the lens is. Okay, and this is a very tight constraint. This is a calibrated mass that you can measure from the data. What are we after? We're after something even harder and more subtle. So the effect that we are after, right, I've been talking about how, so these blue blobs that you see represent background galaxies. And these gray blobs that you see denote cluster galaxies, which are embedded in a smooth dark matter potential, but these galaxies have their own individual dark matter halos. So that's what is shown in red. They have these sort of halos of dark matter in which these galaxies exist. So notice that the presence of dark matter in these halos has caused a coherent tangential elongation in the shapes of these blue galaxies. However, note that the presence of another nearby galaxy distorts, breaks that tangential pattern, which just illustrates the same anisotropy that I was talking about. And what we want to do is to quantify the anisotropy in the shear field and use that to constrain the properties of a typical dark matter clump in the cluster. And in order to do that, what we end up, where we start off, is an image, a high resolution image, to identify all the arcs, to identify the multiple images. And then we use an adaptive ray tracing code that allows you to do the mapping between the source plane and the lens plane that best reproduces the observed data. Okay? And what you do is you optimize the mass distribution. So you start out with your HDR profile and see if you can reproduce the data. You never can. And then you start adding clumps and see what possible distribution. So you need to partition the total mass of the cluster into small scale clumps and a large scale smooth control. And then you see what combination actually gives you the best fit. And it turns out that there's actually something much more sensible you can do, a step that I will get to in a minute. There are some other observed correlations in clusters that you can actually exploit. It's not as random as it just sounds, you know, this partitioning it and see what works. Okay? What we do know about some systematic correlations for galaxies that are sitting in clusters, we can actually exploit. Okay, and I'll just get one more. And what are the properties we're really after? We're after the sizes of these little clumps, dark matter halos, the masses of a typical clump. And what we ideally like to get out is that mass function is an inventory of, you know, as many clumps as a function of mass that we can get at from the lensing effect. And ideally, we want to compare that to structure formation simulations that give us predictions for how a cluster forms. That's independent of any lensing. So in the cold dark matter paradigm, we have a very well-developed theory of how structure forms in the universe from small density fluctuations that get amplified over time. So you have a very independent way of looking at a cluster, and then you can compare and see how what you extract from gravitational lensing, whether that makes sense. Okay, so that's what we are doing now. So what are these subhalos? I will call them subhalos, these clumps. These subhalos typically have surface mass density. Remember, in lensing, surface mass density is what goes, right? So the surface mass density profiles for the subhalos look something like this. Once again, they're sort of heaped up in the center, and then they follow. And there are many parameterizations, you know, singular isothermal sphere, and a lot of kind of white profile. They all have slight differences in shape. But what we are most sensitive to in lensing is not so much the detail of these shapes and how they fall out, but the total mass, the integrated mass within an aperture. Okay? We are very sensitive from those anisotropies that we extract of the total mass that is enclosed within some region over which we see the anisotropy. So in some sense, it's a measure of the region over which the local gravitational potential that will come dominates over the global smooth path. And this method that I'm going to show you, so I mentioned that there is, so these, the ways in which we parameterize these clumps, there are a few relevant quantities that we use to parameterize these profiles. So in order to effectively use the fact that we know that galaxy halos have this shape, we also know in addition that the velocity dispersion of galaxies, so that's the velocity of stars in these galaxies that are inside clusters, which are dark matter halos, individual dark matter halos around them, we know that the measured velocity dispersion of the stars correlates with the total luminosity of that galaxy. Okay, and the correlation is the one called R, and this is called the Faber-Jacobson law. And that is an observation, an empirical relationship that's independent of gravitational lensing. Okay, it's something that's very well established in clusters, and we exploit that. The reason we exploit that is it allows us to scale, allows us to reduce the number of parameters over which we have to optimize this distribution of mass onto small scales and large scales. Well, each of these clumps hosts a galaxy. And the properties and the velocity dispersion of stars in that clump hosted in that galaxy of a given luminosity is well understood by an observed empirical correlation. So what do we do now? So we just calculate, as I said, we partition the mass between a large-scale clump and a small-scale clump, and you can do it either as I-squared, which is what we did 5 years ago, and since then we have now started using Markov chain Monte Carlo methods and Bayesian optimization, and as a function of prior parameter assumptions for these clumps, we have a very good idea of when we have a good match to the lensing effects, that are observed. So we do that. So what we get, so these are parameters that are used to characterize these sums. So this is, these are the posterior probability distributions for the best fit model that we eventually get. Okay, so we have a very good idea of what our errors are and, you know, how good our models are, and so on and so forth. And we know it as a function of outliers. So now let's go back to AVAL 2218. And before I show you the missing results, I would like to show you this clip, this movie of a simulation performed by the Zurich group. This particular one was published by Jules Diamant, 2003. So this is the formation, this zooms in the formation of an individual cluster in the universe. What you see here in these yellow blips are actually not stars, they're actually dark matter particles. Rocked up, they look like the bright and yellow. So this is just the how cold dark matter evolves in a universe, and how a cluster of galaxies rather similar to AVAL 2218 would be produced in the universe. So you see a nice bimodal mass distribution, and what you see here are all these subclumps. And notice the work that I've been trying to push in front of you is one image. I'm trying to do an inventory of these subclumps. Let me just go back and show you. So notice, so this is an n-body simulation, high-resolution numerical cosmological simulation of structure formation. That's just the redshift, so it's time. And the cluster is assembling. These clusters are the most recently assembled objects in the universe. And gravity is the only force in general. There's nothing else. There's no aggregating under gravity. And notice that these clumps that are surviving, these are the sub-Jaegers. So from these simulations, I have an independent inventory of how much of the mass of a cluster is distributed in these clumps as opposed to the spin haze, which is the smooth density distribution. Okay. So now what I can do is I want to extract this information from the lensing data. So we produce models like these. So these are best fit mass models, which give us constraints on the number of clumps. And this is the clump distribution that we extract. And I've used the same color coding as the simulation to show you that these are the locations, the radial locations, and the heights of these peaks are proportional to the mass. So we have a full inventory of masses of clumps that are above 10 to the 10 solar masses in this cluster. So the total mass of the cluster is 10 to the 15 solar masses. Okay. And we can do a very good inventory of all masses, all clumps, of about 10 to the 10.5 or above. So we have a good inventory of these mass clumps, these mass scale clumps. And where do I get that limit from? That limit is just from the resolution of the observational data. That's the best we can do at the moment. It actually is pretty damn good, as you'll see in a minute when we compare the simulations.
Is that limit just set by the number of background galaxies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Number of background galaxies that you have that you can actually capture within the tidal radius of the point. So to show you another visualization of the same, so rotate it so that you can see. So these are all the clumps, you know, and here is the smooth sort of dark matter distribution. The previous one I sort of remove the smooth background dark matter distribution to see if you can see the clear stuff. And what this is showing you the shear distribution, the strength of the shear, okay, as a function of radial position for the best fit mass model. And the reason I want you to take a look at this is because there are regions far from the center of the cluster. Okay, so much of the mass of the cluster is heaped in the center. But far from the center, there are actually regions well outside the center where you see these red pixels. There are very strong distortions. So these local potential wells, the gravity of these clumps can be locally quite dominant. Okay, so they can produce very strong shearing in very particularly small regions, even at the outskirts of the density. You of course expect very strong distortions in the center, as I mentioned earlier. So the question is, we can do so, it's not a one-hit wonder, we can now do this for quite a few clusters. And I've done and left the analysis for several clusters, and this is just to show you a smattering. So this is the mass function of clumps. We have substructures, subhalos, clumps inside these clusters. And these are for different clusters, and this is the average. and notice that the limits, I am not very sensitive to very low mass clumps because they don't produce appreciable lensing effects. Okay, so statistically. So I have a cutoff below which I'm not really sensitive. And what am I mean, it's not sensitive. Why? Because in my scheme, in my inventory, all the clumps that are on the low mass scale get counted up as the smooth. Okay, they're added in the smooth. Which I have to get the total mass right because I have to get the full lensing right. So that's all that's happening. So at the very small mass clumps in the real data are actually getting collapsed into the smoother distribution, into the proportionality proportion of the smooth distribution. And the upper mass, I'm probably quite complete at the upper mass limit. Because the more massive clumps will have very strong local effects that I should be able to pick up. So I should be much more complete on the skin, and I should be incomplete on the low mass limit. And what's the charm of doing this is that I can actually now directly compare with the results from these simulations. So what I'm showing you here in the black histogram and the gray shaded area are the average subhalo mass function distributions derived from those simulations that I showed you. In fact, they are derived from a very special set of simulations called the Millennium Run, which is the largest simulation of the largest box size of the universe that's been performed to date. So there's a superposition. The error that you have here is because it's averaged over many clusters that are located where this particular cluster is in the box. So what you notice here right away is that the match is remarkable. There are no free parameters in this, right? So as far as I'm concerned, it's a miracle they fell on the same plot. There are no adjustable parameters. This was independently derived. This is independently derived. They just overpowered. So it's remarkable that it agrees with the prediction of cold dark matter. And you may wonder, why am I being so abusive about it? I'm being abusive about it because if you go one mass scale lower in cold dark matter, so if you go down to galaxy scales, so rather than 10 to the 15 solar masses, if I go down to 10 to the 12 solar masses, which is like our galaxy, and I look at all the small scale clumps inside our galaxy, which would correspond to the number of satellites in our galaxy, there's a huge problem. The theory predicts thousands, and we see 16 to 24. Okay? So it turns out that that problem is not a characteristic feature of cold dark matter. In fact, it's a problem that is attributable more to the efficiency of galaxy formation in tiny halos. So it turns out that for clusters of galaxies, there is no such crisis. There's rather good agreement. Notice, however, after I'm waxing lyrical about agreement, there's no disagreement with this cluster. Yeah.
So you're saying that some clumps are there, they just don't have variance. They have
no, but in my case, no, they have variance.
Right? Not being around the Milky Way.
Most likely. That solution is probably the most likely solution. But either, no, I think. But what I think, I don't think there are actually Earth mass subclumps. So okay, that's something we can get into later. But I think that there is a small scale cutoff probably. But that even that there are only a fair number of dark matter halos with not a whole lot of mass in them, but that haven't formed stars or have formed stars so inefficiently that they're very, very faint and we're unlikely to detect them. Absolutely. And there's evidence for that from other scales.
In the way you built your model, every bump has an optimal.
Absolutely.
In the simulation, is that also?
Well, the simulation, there is no variance.
Oh, there are.
So it's rather that they fit. So the association of galaxies with clumps, the way I've done it, seems to kind of work out. So, and it doesn't work. That's the point. It doesn't work out if I go one scale down in the mass spectrum. Okay, so as I said, there's one cluster that actually stands out. This is O24. And, you know, I was very curious as to why this doesn't work. Why doesn't this one match?
So what are we looking at here? Like,
it's a mass function of clumps. So it's an inventory of all the small scale clumps.
Yeah, I understand it doesn't match. Where are those compared to it from?
The red offset that you see here, red above the statistical deviation of the 3 sigma band. So you see this clump that's sitting out here, the sister band piece, whereas everyone else is sort of within the 3 sigma comparison with the simulations. So So there's something, but these are particular objects, right? So while the lensing effect itself does not depend on the dynamical state of the cluster, let's go and look at that particular cluster to see what's interesting there. And it turns out there's something very interesting in this cluster. And it's very illustrative of yet another limitation in lensing work. So this is that same cluster that I showed you earlier, which you have multiple images, 5 images of the same background object. And so what we did is our group went in what Hubble Space Telescope time to image far out from the cluster center. You know, well, well outside this region. So this whole region fits in the tiny, the first, the innermost contour that you see here. So we're probing way out from the center of the data. And so these are all the galaxies that belong to the cluster that we know are part of the cluster that are in the lens plane that I've plotted here. And the mass distribution that we derived from this cluster, going well further out, right? So starting from here, going well further out, these are what the clumps look like. Okay, so what is really interesting is these are the projected locations of those clumps. And it turns out that we went back and did a redshift survey of this cluster. And what we found in this particular cluster is that you have two clumps that are actually separated in redshift. Okay? That we are assuming the disagreement possibly comes from the fact that we have ignored the fact that the mass distribution of this cluster is very highly elongated along the line of sight. Okay, extremely elongated. So this one lens plane is not a great. So as you can see where this is going to be an important limitation in any use that we want to make of gravitational lensing to study the geometry now, right? Because how do we know how elongated a particular structure is? And some of them would be...
So there's one enormous structure for this space pointing straight at us.
Absolutely. And it turns out that those are likely the objects that are also going to give you the dramatic lensing. The surface mass densities. Systematically, those would be the best lenses, and you know, we'd be going after them, and they would all be preferentially the things that are pointing right at us.
But isn't that potentially a nice test of the volume or kind of the model? Because you should be able to take slices through it and ask how many things you should see.
Right, so we did do that, and it turns out that even within the volume of the Millennium, you wouldn't see even more, and that's why we couldn't make it more. Okay, so these are very rare. This particular one is rare. But, yeah.
And don't you, I mean, it's analogous to the gradient refract index problem. So don't you run into a problem with the uniqueness of the solution once you allow it also to vary in depth?
Absolutely. And that's the limitation. It becomes really hard to figure out how unique your reconstructed model is. So the only way around it, though, here, is that you can actually do a redshift survey, and you can map what is where, and try to see if you can incorporate that extension into the model. Sorry, I think it was 5 minutes for that, is that all right? So what you can do now, you can repeat the kind of analysis that I did and look as a function of radius, you know, what is the mass of a typical halo, a typical clump? And you find that the mass of a typical clump increases with radius. And that's interesting, and that is in very good agreement with our understanding, dynamical understanding of what happens in the cluster. We think that galaxies with very extended dark matter halos are attracted into the center of a cluster, they come merging in, as they come merging in, the dark matter halo gets stripped as they flow in, okay, and reach the center. And this explanation makes sense because at this distance, about 5-ish megaparsecs, actually there isn't enough time, given the typical velocity of the galaxy, it will take a Hubble time to decide, but this one has not made a passage through the center yet. Okay? It will take a Hubble time. So this one has not been tidily stripped, so it should be more massive, and it is, compared to a guy who's here, who's probably made a close passage to the center. Okay, at least timing-wise, there has been enough time for the universe for that to have happened. We don't actually know, because we don't know, we get a snapshot, right? We don't know the integrated dynamical history of this object. And of course, you can do a similar comparison with simulations, And there's very good agreement. I plotted them offset, actually, just by doing seeing that the slope is the same. Actually, it's very good. I'll kind of skip that and I'll quickly move to a couple of things I want to show. So one other thing we can do is the smooth distribution. We can also characterize, why don't we characterize the terms? We can characterize the smooth distribution, the properties of the smooth distribution, the shapes of the density profiles from the shear, and the radial distributions of the mass in these clusters. And it turns out that this blue dashed line is what was believed to be the universal density profile for the Navarro frames and white profile, and the mass distribution corresponding to that profile. So it turns out this particular case, it doesn't quite match that well. So the best fit is provided roughly by a NMW profile, but it doesn't really actually fit each and every cluster. Okay, so there are many clusters that fit very well, and I haven't shown you. I'm just making the point that there are clusters that don't fit as well. So it's not really as universal as fit. And this is just to show you the cases where there are some good fits, there's some bad fits as well. And the other quantity that you can get a handle on is the inner slope of the density profile. And I'll just quickly run past this one. That you can get a constraint on the inner slope because we have a constraint on the integrated mass within a particular radius. And we can measure the velocity dispersions of stops in these galaxies, in these central galaxies. Okay, so when those two things combine, you can actually get a constraint on the density profile. I really want to quickly skip to getting to the dark energy bulb, so, which I think has some new results that I want to show. But before I do that, let me just give you a tally and data analysis. So a tally of how well the lambda CDM model does on cluster scales from just comparison with the lensing data. It does rather well, actually. It would have been nice. I mean, I thought that I'd find some major disagreement. Become very famous because you become famous when you invent a crisis. But we do. So it all seems to kind of fit within the three sigma everything. That's it's kind of boring. But anyway, so moving on to trying to constrain the geometry of the universe using cluster arcs. So let's get to this is the real thing. This cluster is the real thing. So it's a cluster called AVL-689. It has 32 multiply image systems. So more than 100 of these little arcs and arcs. And you can't see them here, but you can see them on the screen with all the space telescope image with the advanced camera. And 19 of them have measured directions. Yeah, spectacular. It's the largest number. This cluster has the best mass model ever constructed. Okay. But by nature, because it has 32 multiply image systems, you immediately know, I told you, it has a pretty complicated orientation to it. Most likely to be this. Probably see why shape. Because it's quite unlikely to have something on the primary systems otherwise. But you need a huge surface mass density, a washing surface mass density along the line of sight to give you a reasonable amount of numbers. So that's a problem, but hey. So what's the idea? The idea is we go back to our length figure. So you have these two sources, so two sets of galaxies that are multiple image that you see. So this is the image plane. So you have this source that is image into 3, and another one here that is image into 4, and this is what you see. Then if you take the ratio of the positions of the two sets of sources, the ratio of the multiple images, the positions of the multiple images, you take that ratio, that's just proportional to the gradient of the gravitational potential of this cluster between us. But you take the ratio, right? So you are sensitive to the gradient of the gravitational potential of all the stuff between here in a cylinder between here and us. And for this chap, it's between a cylinder between here and us. And if you take that ratio and you know this mass distribution quite well, then you have to worry about the stuff here along the line of sight, but then you get a pure sort of geometric measure. So you get the ratio of the linear bands, the distances, the ratio of ratios that allows you to constrain the cosmology. You get a ratio of ratios that encapsulates a dependence of a quake on omega matter, which is the matter content of the universe, and dark energy, omega x, some component that we don't know, which you can parameterize with an equation of state p equals w times rho. This is the standard parameterizing an equation of state with a constant the constant W, K, and Q minus 1. So what I'm showing you here are constraints on omega matter at this equation of state quantum of W, and minus 1 corresponds to the classical cosmological constant as well. And these are from simulations of clusters, where what we've done is we've simulated structure formation in the universe, we've gone out and looked at cylinders behind clusters, tagged particular sources, multiply image them, and then go back and try to reconstruct the mass of the cluster and constrain the geometry. And what you find is that if you have, remember I mentioned to you, a family is the number of images produced by a single source. So if you have two families and 40 clusters, you get constraints that look like this. What's interesting is in the degeneracy direction, right, of this method. So that's the degeneracy direction of this method, looks like this. And you know, and one can play the game and see what is the optimal combination. Do you stack a lot of clusters with a few families, or do you find one cluster, like 1689, that has an enormous number of families? So which is your, what are the trade-off to see what's the best way forward for getting this constraint? And it turns out, what's interesting about this degeneracy direction is overblocked here are the degeneracy directions for all the other techniques currently used to constrain your energy. Okay? So the cluster methods are the cluster random fraction, which is this blue contours. Notice that we are distinct, the different degeneracy direction that's useful. And we have a very similar degeneracy direction to the supernovae, because it's also a geometrical method, like the supernovae. But weak lensing, we are these sort of gray contours, and the WMAP constraints are distinctly aligned differently. So you get a very different degeneracy space. So, you know, it's a very effective, complementary way that you can then use to actually constrain. So what do we do? So this is a work in progress, I'll quickly skip over it. So what we really need to do is to do as good a reconstruction of the mass as we can. So this is the plot to show you. So this is the cluster 1689. I zoomed into the center, and this is the central region. And these crosses show you the positions of multiple images, which have measured spectra. And what you find, the constraints that we have, so these are preliminary results. And I haven't folded in too many of the errors very carefully. Just sort of, this is the first set of results that we have. And I just wanted to check that compared to our simulations that are using the direction is recovered. It is. And it turns out, you know, this is sort of what we get. Okay. I'm not going to push any of the values of this track. So now just wrap up in the next two slides, showing you what the key limitations are, and I've alluded to them already. So this is the cluster O24, the one that was sticking out in my comparison with simulations, and I mentioned to you that if you do a redshift survey behind the cluster, which Margaret Geller has very kindly done recently, you actually find all the structure out to redshift one. So this is the cluster, this is what you pick out as a cluster, but there's a lot of stuff behind you. And so what's the problem? I am ascribing all the lensing to have been is attributed to this cloud. And there is all this mass in small clumps behind it that actually contribute and produce very, very small deflections that all add up and contribute to the total lensing. And there's an error that is incurred in the reconstruction of both the mass as well as any geometrical components that comes from this structure along the line of sight. And so what can we do and why is that? The reason this is important is the probability for multiple imaging is highly enhanced if you have a clump behind you. Okay, so the sources are here. We are here as observers, and this is the foreground cluster lens. So if you have just a galaxy that lines up behind you, your cross-section, your probability to multiply image goes up dramatically. And if you have something more massive, it goes up even more dramatically, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that allows you, that gives you errors in your reconstruction of both the masses and the geometry of the image. So the other thing that's really important in these ratio methods is the location. So this is a cluster in which I have no clumps behind, and this is the location of an arc, and I have a smooth distribution of elongated clumps behind it, and the position, remember I'm taking the ratio of positions, so that's a critical factor here, you return the position appreciably. So that gives you an error in any estimate that you obtain. So anyway, I will quickly tell you that there's going to be a lot of activity in terms of data in this field. There are many planned surveys, One doesn't know what's going to happen when, so please, some of them will happen in the right time zone, but none of these numbers are but there's going to be a lot of activity, and I just want to conclude that this is a method that I think is very, very powerful. And what it allows us to do very neat and nifty tests of structure formation paradigm using observation of data. And what is particularly useful about this observational data set obtained by gravitational lensing, it doesn't matter if the cluster is has a lot of turbulent motions in it, whether it's relaxed, it's not, and so on and so forth. So it's a technique that depends only on the surface mass density and its distribution. So I want to stop there and sort of hope I've sold you the idea. You know, clusters, the reason I'm doing this hard sell for clusters and galaxies is that clusters are actually very, very complicated objects. But as in life, I think anything that is not complicated is not interesting, so in my opinion, right? So I think they're very, very interesting objects because you can learn a lot of physics, you can construct cosmological parameters. This is very great for everyone. I mean, for the people who are obsessed with parameters as well as people who want to understand the basic physics. So I've just stopped with some beautiful pictures of background galaxies that you see behind these lenses. It's not work that I'm directly involved in, but just to show you the power of cluster lenses. So you see these galaxies that you would never see otherwise, that you could never see otherwise with any instrumentation, past, present, future. You could never see them. Okay? And our only hope for catching the first generation of galaxies that ever formed in the universe, in my opinion, is behind these cluster lenses. It's a shame that they're not more common, but they're common enough. Thanks for stopping.